This week's parsha is Akev. Now, it's interesting because the second chapter of Shema has a very subtle difference from the first chapter of Shema. And this is one of these things that if you read it in English, you'll never catch it. The second parsha is interesting because what it does is it presents for us, I'm not exactly sure how to put it, I'll say, a divine reward and punishment. It says, if you follow the laws and if you follow the commandments, this and this and this will happen. And if you don't, then this and this and this will happen. The first chapter, Shema, after the initial opening statement, the Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, continues, the Ahavta es Hashem Elokecha, you should love the Lord God, right, with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your possessions. The second chapter, Shema, begins, Vayayim Shemoa, Tishmu el mitzvah asher anochi mitzaveschem yom, le'avos Hashem Elokeichem, lovdo b'chol levavchem v'chol nafshechem, which is a very similar opening. And if you follow the commandments, you should love God, serve Him with all your heart and all your soul. Now, the difference is, if you read the English, you really won't catch it. The Hebrew, the first chapter of Shema is in the singular, b'havta, which is singular, you, individual. While the second chapter of Shema is in the plural. Okay, that itself is something which is interesting, because the second chapter of Shema is the chapter which deals with much broader types of reward. Like, if you follow all the commandments, then you will have food to eat, and the land will, there'll be rain in the proper seasons. And again, those of us who come from the West don't necessarily appreciate to what extent a place like the Middle East, Israel specifically, is a place which is dependent upon rainfall in order to help the economy. This is true in modern times as well, and was all the more true in those days. If rain fell in the proper seasons, then there would be produce. If there's produce, then there is money, there's food, and people can live in comfort. On the other hand, if rain does not fall in the proper seasons, then there could be a drought, then there could be starvation, and there will be death. So this blessing to have rain in the proper season is no small thing. So it's interesting that the promise for the reward takes place in the second chapter of Shema, which is in the plural. And the reason for that, I think, is quite simple. When you talk about rain in the proper season, that cannot be done on an individual basis. It's not going to be that in this field it rains, but in the next-door neighbor's field it's not going to rain. Which means the second chapter of Shema, which speaks about you as a community, if you follow the words of God, this will be the result. And here it talks about the produce and so on going. But when it talks to the first chapter of Shema, when it speaks to the individual, then obviously the reward is going to be a different type of reward, but cannot be on this broader national scale. With that as an introduction, so there, I've already fulfilled the advertisement for the class that I'm going to talk about this week's portion. With that, I want to go into something, I don't want to say deeper, but something which is intriguing, which also took place this week. And that's the holiday of Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av, which was yesterday. I don't know if you've ever heard of this holiday. And it's one of these strange things that has actually even captured the imagination of the secular Israeli public and is known as the holiday of love. They've turned it into some type of a Valentine's Day. There, right, lots of weddings take place. And I want to try to explain what this day is about. Our sages tell us that there are no accidents. This is actually very funny that I'm saying that. One of the sages who says it is this book that I have, which I didn't bring for this class. I brought it for my next class, which is L'Shloach HaKadosh. So I'm saying there's no accidents. So there you go. This book is sitting here right now. It's not an accident, I guess. L'Shloach HaKadosh says that when the rabbis made which portion we read in each week, there is an intrinsic relationship between that week and between that portion. This is not always obvious to us. Sometimes we see it, and sometimes we see it more, sometimes we see it less. This week, with Tu B'Av, the 15th day of Av, I think that there is a connection to this concept that I spoke of earlier, the concept of responsibility and mutual responsibility, and therefore reward or punishment on a national level is going to be directly correlated to the way that the people act as a community, as a nation. So let's begin to delve into this 15th day of Av. One of the books of the Talmud is called Ta'anit, or Ta'anis. What Ta'anit means is fasting. It's a tractate that deals with the various fast days. tells us when you fast, how you fast, what you do when you fast, what you don't do when you fast. And at the very end of the Mishnah, the last comment in the Mishnah, it says, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Shimon the son of Gamliel said, Lo hayu yom tovim liYisrael kechamisha asar ba'av v'chayom kippurim. There weren't celebrated holidays for the Jewish people. There was never days which were as happy as the 15th day of Av and Yom Kippur. Now there's two things which are strange in this statement. One is, there are certain Jewish days which are happy, correct? I mean, we're not that depressing as a religion. We do have some happy days. Unfortunately, non-religious Jews only tend to be involved in Judaism when they're in unhappy occasions. I mean, correct? With the exception of a bar mitzvah or a wedding. So then you have a funeral, and you have Rosh Hashanah, and you have Yom Kippur, and you get this sort of feeling that it's a pretty morbid, pretty depressed, oppressed religion. I mean, it's a shame that that more people that are not really practicing come and don't celebrate Hanukkah more, or Purim more, or Simchas Torah. There are some days which are pretty pretty happy, or bordering on the wild, if you will. But the Mishnah over here tells us that there are the two happiest days, the greatest days, were the 15th of Av and Yom Kippur. Now, one strange thing about this is the 15th of Av is a day that we don't know that much about. It's never mentioned in the Torah. The Torah doesn't tell us anything about this day. We do have all sorts of holidays that are mentioned. Passover, Sukkot, Shavuos, Shana, Yom Kippur. Over here, we don't even know what this 15th day of Av is. Matter of fact, it's never mentioned in the Mishnah, aside from this comment by saying, it was one of the happiest days of the year, but what is it? So one thing we have to figure out is what it is. The second thing that it says is, and Yom Kippur. Now, Yom Kippur doesn't necessarily strike us as this, you know, great party mood. You know, Yom Kippur, if anything, is a little bit more solemn, a little bit more serious. Yom Kippur, you have, I would say, religious people who come to shul are absolutely frightened, guilty for what they've done for the year, feeling guilt. People that are not so religious also come to shul on Yom Kippur, hedging their bets a little bit, just in case God does exist and he's watching and he's listening, want to be on the right side over here. What makes this a happy day? How can they tell us it's such a happy day? And it continues and it says, for in these days, Shabbahen, on these days, Benote Yerushalayim, the daughters of Jerusalem, Yotzot Bichli Lavan Shu'alin, they would go out wearing white, borrowed clothing, Shalol Levayesh Amisha Enlo, as to not to embarrass those who don't have it. It says, called Kem Tunum Tfila, there were certain ritual laws that had to be kept, that they would immerse them in the ritual bath. Uvenot Yerushalayim, Yotzot Uchulot Bichramim, they would go out dancing in the vineyards, and what would they say? Mahi Omrot, what would they say? Bechor, young man, Sona Einecha, lift up your eyes, Ura Ma'ata Borerlach, and look and see what you're choosing. Alti Teinecha Benoi, don't only look at beauty, Teinecha B'mishpacha, take a look at family. Why? For it says in the book of Proverbs, Sheker Hachein V'Hevel HaYofi, Isha Yishir Yirat Hashem Hitatalo, that Chein, what I translate? Chein? Yeah, but I want Chein and Yofi to be different.
Grace.
It says that the grace is a lie and that beauty is worthless or nothingness. A woman who fears God, she's the one who should be praised. And then
it's like they're to choose what?
Yes, that's what it sounds like. V'chein hu omer. Okay, but Omer also says, Tnu lo mi priya deh, v'yaluluha b'sharim ma'aseh. It also says, give her the fruit of their hands and let her works praise her in the gates, which means it's the deeds of an individual which are important and not external or exterior things. The deeds are the important thing. V'chein hu omer, and it also says, tsena v'rena, and this conclusion will sound somewhat disjointed, but I'll get back to it. Tsena v'rena means go out and take a look. Benot Zion, daughters of Zion, b'melech Shlomo, at King Solomon, ba'atara she'itrelo imo b'yom chatunato. Take a look at the crown that his mother made for him on the day of his wedding, u'v'yom simchat libo, on the day of his rejoicing. What is b'yom chatunato? What is the day of his wedding? Zematan Torah, the day the Torah was given. Uviyom Simchat Libo, and what is the day of the happiness of his heart? Zebinyan Beit HaMikdash, that is the building of the temple. Shibonevim Herib Yameinu, that it let it be built speedily in our days. And that's the end of the Mishnah. So, this whole thing that I read was the last part of the teaching. There was a lot of things beforehand, and it seems to be an addendum. It's not really connected to anything which comes beforehand. And even within the addendum, there seems to be this last phrase which sounds somewhat disjointed. So just to recap what we've seen, the main idea was that the two happiest days of the year were Yom Kippur and the 15th of Av. On these days, daughters of Jerusalem would go out dancing in the streets. People would go out choosing spouses for one another, and sounds like a real celebration. Now, my suspicion is any of you who have made it to Shul on Yom Kippur have never seen this. Okay?
Yes.
In Yom Kippur, this is what you do in your shul, you go dancing.
No, not dancing, but I always listen, my grandfather says that when Yom Kippur is when the guys choose which girl.
So your grandfather's aware of this, correct? Your grandfather's aware, but have you seen it?
Yeah.
What you're pointing at is that Yom Kippur is a good opportunity of meeting single Jewish people. That's what you're pointing at. Okay.
I don't know if you really. Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av.
Yes. That's the implication of the Mishnah. The two main questions right now are, I mean, how does this fit into what we know about Yom Kippur on the one hand? On the other hand, what is this mysterious day, Tu B'Av? The Gemara continues and explains, and it says, hold it a second. If you're going to say that Yom Kippur is an important day or a day of happiness, I could understand that because Yom Kippur is a day of forgiveness and slichu mechila. Forgiveness and, what do I want to say, mechila? I'll tell you the difference in slicha and mechila. Slicha is for something that you didn't do on purpose. Mechila is for something which you did on purpose. So if you accidentally stepped on someone's toe, you would say slicha. In modern Hebrew as well, sorry, right? If you did it on purpose to somebody and then you want to make up, you will ask them for mechila. Mechila is, you'd say, you could translate as I'm really sorry for what I've done, but maybe atonement is a better word for mechila. So it says that these 2 days were days of forgiveness. Now, and there's one more element to it, but that hold on for 1 second. In the temple times, Yom Kippur was not the same way that it is today. First of all, the Talmud tells us that during the time of the temple, there was a red string which hung in the temple. And they would take the scapegoat, they would take it out of the city, and the scapegoat would be pushed down a mountain. And when the scapegoat died, this red string would turn white. And that was a symbol that their sins were cleansed. Seir la'azazel. Seir la'azazel. So when this red string would turn white, everybody watching this would know at that moment that they were exonerated, that they were forgiven. Now, you know, as it is, Yom Kippur is a day which is full of emotion. And if somebody really does pray with sincerity, and at some point you're told, you're given a sign that you have been forgiven, I think that would be a cause for an incredible response. That would explain the euphoria that the Mishnah seems to be describing. So I would not say that Yom Kippur, from the second they got up in the morning, was like this really happy day, everybody celebrating. But this would sound more like Yom Kippur late in the afternoon. In fact, we're told that when the Kohen Gadol, when the high priest would come out of the temple, and he had successfully come out and done all the service, at that moment people would carry him on their shoulders, and it would take hours for him to get back to his house. Now, that doesn't mean they were eating or drinking or anything else, but there was definitely a whole celebration that broke out. So therefore, our perspective of Yom Kippur as a serious solemn day is absolutely correct. The difference is that in our experience, we don't have any type of audiovisual sign that our prayers really have been answered and that we really have been forgiven. During the times of the temple, they received that, and that's when, I would say, the spontaneous celebration would break out. So therefore, the Gemara says, Yom Kippur I can understand, because what is Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is a day of forgiveness. Yom Kippur is a day that they were cleansed. Forgiveness and cleansing, so therefore, it would be really euphoric. But the Mishnah adds one more element to it. Excuse me, the Talmud adds one more phrase. And it's Yom Shenitnu Bo Luchot HaAchronot. And it's a day when the second tablets were given. Now, this is something which we're not always that familiar with because we don't have that good of a sense of biblical chronology. The Jews came out of Egypt on Passover. 50 days later, they stood by Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, the revelation took place. Moses goes up the mountain for 40 days. Moses comes down the mountain. He's holding the tablets of stone in his hand. When he comes down, he sees, lo and behold, the people are worshiping a golden calf. Moses breaks the tablets. At that point, God engages Moses in dialogue and offers to destroy the entire Jewish people and make a new tribe from Moses, and the Jewish people are history. Moses prays for their forgiveness. Finally, on the first day of Elul, 40 days of prayer take place, from the 17th day, from the 18th day of Tammuz, all the way till the first day to the end of Av, is the prayer takes place. On the first day of Elul, Moses is invited to come up to the mountain. Moses remains up on the mountain the second time also for 40 days, which means that Moses comes down the mountain the second time holding the tablets on Yom Kippur. Okay? Yom Kippur is the 10th of Tishrei, 30 days of Elul, 10 days of Tishrei. We have on the 40th day, Moses comes down, which therefore...
40 days, 40 days, and 40 days.
Correct. Which therefore means that Yom Kippur is the day that the Jewish people were forgiven for the golden calf. That's the day that they received the second tablets. And this is not a coincidence. These two elements are interrelated. Don't think for a second that forgiveness comes by itself and the Torah comes by itself. The fact that they were willing to accept the Torah at that point is what gave them the forgiveness. So these things are interrelated, and therefore the cleansing element of Yom Kippur is interrelated with this concept of their receiving the Torah. And that's what the Gemara is adding over here. That was the last phrase. It's a day of forgiveness and cleansing, and it's the day... Right, it's the day, maybe it's not even the end, it's the day where they receive the second tablet. So therefore, this idea of euphoria of Yom Kippur, and I would say that therefore, this was the first Yom Kippur the Jews celebrated together in the desert, right? They left on Passover, so it's a half year after they've left. So the first Yom Kippur that they celebrated, what kind of day do you think it was? It was a day of celebration, you know? Probably the last, if you say 40, 40, and 40, the last 80 days or so, last couple of months, they've been involved in some really serious soul-searching, and they were at the brink of destruction. And now, forgiveness finally comes on Yom Kippur, so therefore that first Yom Kippur was a day of forgiveness and a day of celebration. And that creates the spiritual structure or infrastructure or charisma of the day of Yom Kippur. So therefore we can understand why Yom Kippur is a happy day. For us, again, not knowing, this lack of knowledge is really what makes it so difficult for us. But what about the 15th day of Av? Now, there are numerous reasons given for the 15th day of Av in the Talmud. Most of the commentators will understand that there is most likely a primary reason, and then there are various secondary reasons which are... which can be heaped on top of it. One reason given, and we'll do them in the proper order of the Talmud, the first one that's given is that it was the day that the tribes were permitted to marry from one tribe to the other. The reference over here is during the time in the desert and when they entered the land of Israel, the tribes were not allowed to marry from one tribe to the other. Each tribe remained independent. The impetus for this was when there were five women, the daughters of Tzlavchad. They approached Moses and they said, our father died in the desert and therefore he will not receive an inheritance if we marry people from other tribes. Therefore, our father's inheritance will be lost from the tribe of Joseph, which is where they were from. So therefore, Moses instructed them to marry from within their own tribe, and that's what continued till... I would say, after the land was captured and settled and much more populated, then at a later point, they were allowed to marry with one another.
So, I always thought that was just Benosik Slavchad.
No, that's not the way the Gemara understands.
Because of five women, nobody could intermarry.
Correct. So the Gemara sets up that this problem, this brought up the problem, and therefore the law of that Moses set down was the practice which they were to have followed for a period of time. till after they got into the land. At a later point, they were allowed to marry one another. That's the way the Talmud explains it.
And the 15th of Av, when they were allowed to intermarry, took place when they were already in Eretz Yisrael.
Absolutely. The second reason which is given is it says that at the time that the tribe of Benjamin was allowed to return to the fold. Now, I'm not going to get involved into this whole discussion, what happened with Benjamin. Suffice it to say that they became set aside from the other tribes because of some sort of outrage that took place. Anyone's really interested in researching this, in the book of Judges, Shoftim, chapters 19, 20, 21, we'll go into some of the detail about this. Something happened, the other tribes got very upset, and Benjamin, they decided that Benjamin would be pushed aside, they will not marry anyone from the tribe of Benjamin. This lasted for a whole generation. When that generation died out, the next generation, they continued to marry them again. Over here again, the Talmud says the day they were allowed to marry one another happened on Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av. So far we have two reasons given. Both of them are connected to marriage, which is interesting, which at least could give some part of this marriage theme to it. Next reason which it gives is that this is the day that the people stopped dying in the desert. Now, this one is a bit more morbid and also needs to be understood. The Medrash tells us, first, let's start with tradition before we get to the Medrash. We know from the Torah that when the spies came back, the spies all started to cry. Correct? Now, if we'll continue from that Yom Kippur, just to give you the point of reference, from that Yom Kippur, they started to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle. They began to collect all of the utensils immediately, and they didn't start to build it till Hanukkah. They finished building it by the beginning of Nisan, which is in the springtime, 2 weeks before Passover. They celebrate the second Passover. The spies are sent sometime in the springtime. They return back after another 40 days, interesting, a 40-day mission. They return back on the 9th of Av. Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av is when the spies come back. The spies come back, start complaining, saying, we cannot capture this land. All the people start to cry. God says, you're crying for nothing. I'll give you a reason to cry. And this will be a day of infamy throughout the generations, and this will be a day that you will cry throughout the generations. So that's the beginning of Tisha B'Av. And I talked a little about this last week on Tisha B'Av, those of you that were there. Then it tells us that, now here's where it gets morbid, that it was said that this whole generation will die in the desert. So the Medrash tells us that every year, on Tisha B'Av, they only died on Tisha B'Av. So every year, right, the day before Tisha B'Av, they would dig graves, everyone would get into the graves, lay down, and in the morning, around 15,000 of them would be dead. In the morning, the rest of them would get up, and the ones who were dead, they would cover them up in the graves. And it says that every year they did this, and every year another percentage died. When they got to the last year, everyone dug their graves, got in the graves, nobody died. So their initial thought was they must have made a mistake in the counting. I mean, they didn't have expert timepieces then, so they got back in the grave the next day. Nothing happened. 10th, the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th. When they get to the 15th, they realize then that they did not make a mistake. Why? What happens in the 15th?
God is merciful.
No. What happened in the 15th? When you look up in the sky in the 15th? What do you see? Full moon. So you see the full moon, you realize it's not the 9th anymore, because by the 9th it's not a full moon yet. 15th it's a full moon, they realize that they could not make that much of a mistake, and they start to celebrate because they realize that the decree is over. Okay, now you're right, because God was compassionate. But so the 15th is the day of the full moon. Now this is a very strange idea. And by the way, my suspicion is this is the main reason for Tu B'Av. It's the day, because Tu B'Av should be seen as an extension of Tisha B'Av. The 9th of Av is the day of destruction. The 9th of Av is the day of mourning. Over here, this Medrash is absolutely connecting the two. It's okay, connect the 9th of Av and the idea of the 15th of Av, and saying the 15th of Av ends Tisha B'Av. There's one more reason which is given over here. Well, there's actually two more reasons. One is that this was the day that they would stop chopping wood for the temple during temple times. Now, why would that make it such a happy day? It's also a little strange. They stopped chopping wood. Why? because it was towards the end of the summer, by the 15th of Av. And also, see, different, I don't know where all you people come from, but different climates have different types of feelings to them. Sukkos in Israel in the spring, in the fall, is very different from Sukkos in Poland. And you can see that from where people lived in Poland and how they write about the bitter cold and going to the Sukkot. Going to the Sukkot in Israel is a different experience. Passover in the springtime, if you live in the southern hemisphere, you do not appreciate Passover. Passover is a time of regeneration. It's a time when things are beginning to grow again. But it's interesting. The Jewish holidays on the whole, the biblical holidays, are all in the spring or in the fall. Holidays are not in the winter or the summer. The Maharal from Prague pointed out that that's the way it was supposed to be. The summer and the winter are too intense, either too cold or too warm. And the spring or the fall are the times when the holidays are to be celebrated. It indicates an aspect of Judaism which is supposed to be much more comfortable rather than this extreme position. So says the Maharal. It's interesting then that the destruction that takes place, the Tisha B'Av, is in the heart of the summer, right? In the heat of the summer is Tisha B'Av. The 15th day of Av, we're told, is the day when the heat of the summer comes to an end. The summer stops, and things start to get cooler and cooler. The nights begin to get longer, and the days begin to get cooler. That's the 15th of Av, the end of the summer, the end of the heat, which also, if you really think about it, does connect with the idea of Tisha B'Av, is this extreme that was not supposed to be. We were not supposed to respond in that way. Tisha B'Av is this accident of history. It was not supposed to be a time of, was not supposed to be this time of fasting. The idea of the nights getting longer also has a second reference to it, which is clear from the Talmud, and that it's a time that you don't have to spend as much time working. Again, in the olden days, they did not have electricity, which means your time of productivity out in the field or out at work would be during daylight. Over the summer, you would have a lot more time to be productive in terms of your vocation, but you would probably have a lot less time in terms of your study, because the nights were times that were spent studying. You'd sit there with your candle or your lantern, and then you can study. During the daytime, people would be involved in their work. So therefore, the Talmud continues and says, but once the nights are getting longer, now you'll have more time to study. You know, and fortunate or blessed is the individual who studies, and woe unto the person who does not use that time in an effective way. The other thing that it says is that, well, actually, I'm sorry, there are two more. I'm not sure if I'm going to get a chance to explain all of them. One is, it says that this was the day that the people that were killed in Beitar were permitted to be buried. If you've ever heard of Beitar, after the Second Temple was destroyed, there was a rebellion, the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Many more people were killed during this rebellion than were killed during the destruction. The rebellion was squashed, the leaders killed, and many Jews were killed. The blood that flowed from Beitar was unbelievable. The Romans would not allow the Jews to bury their dead. Finally, after an extended period of time, they allowed them to bury them, and that was also said to be the 15th day of Av. So here you have a couple of themes having to do with marriage, a couple of themes having to do with burial. And it says that the miracle took place and the bodies did not decay. And they were able to bury them with some type of dignity. The last reason which is given over here, and I did not do this in the exact order, the last reason which is given is the strangest to me. It says that on this day, a king by the name of Hoshea, the son of Ella, canceled the guards on the roads and allowed people to come and travel up to Jerusalem. There was a wicked king named Yeravam ben Nevat. Yeravam was, in his youth and as a young man, was a wonderful man, a wonderful leader, a scholar. There's a whole passage in the Bible, where God turns to Yeravam and says, because of the indiscretions of Solomon, Solomon did not follow the word of God, because of Solomon's indiscretions, he takes some clothing and he rips it into 12 pieces and says, 10 of these pieces are for you and 2 of these pieces are for Shlomo, for Solomon. Right? And at that moment, he was given the right to become king over 10 of the tribes. Now, once he was king, he ran into a little bit of an intrigue. He decides to build his own temple with golden calves and the whole thing, and he builds a temple of idolatry. This man Yerovam, as I said, was a great man because of this insane jealousy that he did not want his people to go into Jerusalem, and because he was so egotistical, he'd rather lead his whole people astray religiously than have them come back to Jerusalem and worship. Not only did he build his own temples, but he put guards on the road to make sure nobody made their way up to Jerusalem. This guy named Hoshea ben Ella was also an idolater. He also worshipped in these temples with these golden calves. But what was really strange is that it's considered to be a great day because he took the guards down. Now again, don't think for a second the man was religious. I just said he wasn't. I mean, he was not involved in the temple in Jerusalem. He was involved in idolatry. So why? Okay, he is liberal, he's politically correct. He says anybody can serve whoever they want to serve. Whoever wants to go to Jerusalem. Whoever wants to come here, come here. But why would the day be considered to be so great? Now, I want to suggest the following. We have around 8 minutes left unless I go over. I think that most of the things over here have a common denominator which we may not have suspected or seen. And this hit me. I was going over this passage on this past Shabbos afternoon. I was looking at the passage, and something about it hit me, and I want to share with you the idea that I had. Let's go back for one moment. If I want to look at the basis of hatred, and this I did talk about a little bit on Tisha B'Av, the basis of hatred between people, of jealousy between people, in the non-Jewish world, or the general world, the universal, would be Cain and Abel. That's the first time you see in the Torah any type of hatred. If I want to look in the Jewish world, the source of hatred is Joseph and his brothers. Okay, that's clear. The Joseph and the brother hatred actually has one earlier step to it, which is where the problems came from. Joseph's brothers is where it exploded, but the problem was the tension between the sons of Rachel versus the sons of the other wives of Jacob. The sons of the other tribes could not accept the sons of Rachel, and part of the problem was because of jealousy, because they knew that Rachel was the favorite wife. That is the core in the Jewish community of all the problems that we have in terms of hatred. Again, that's a theological statement. What's interesting is that, let's start going through some of the sources again. The daughters of Tzlavchad came from the tribe of Joseph. Because of the daughters of Tzlavchad from this tribe of Joseph, the tribes were not allowed to marry within one another. When they couldn't marry within one another, what would the result be? I would say some type of exaggerated nationalistic pride within each tribe. Each tribe would feel the specialness of themselves, and probably at the same time, the downside is that you tend to knock the other tribes. Which means if there's going to be real unity, then you can't have these artificial barriers existing between the tribes. So therefore, the day that they were able to break down the barriers between the tribes, and again, it's interesting to me that the impetus there is Joseph, these daughters from the tribe of Joseph, the day that they break down these barriers is going to be a day of celebration. Okay, hold on to that for a second. The second thing that we saw was the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin also comes from Rachel. This Joseph and Benjamin come from Rachel. That the other tribes set up this rule that one cannot marry from Benjamin. So as long as Benjamin is pushed aside, there's going to be a problem within the community. You don't have the unity that we're speaking of. What was the major theme of the hatred between Joseph and the brothers, or the symbol of it? Not the theme, the symbol. The symbol, I would say, is the coat. The coat of many colors. Jacob, who loves his son, gives him the coat. Okay? So now, I want to make the following suggestion, and then we'll see what we can do with it. I think that the ninth of Av symbolizes destruction of the temple, and that's clear. The 15th of Av symbolizes the solving of the problem of the destruction of the temple. Why am I saying that? Go back to the first one. 9th of Av in the desert, they didn't want to go to the land of Israel. They all start to die. What happens on the 15th of Av? They come out of the graves. The 9th of Av is over. Therefore, the power of the 9th of Av destroys the temple. I want to suggest the power of the 15th of Av is the power that builds the temple. Okay? It's interesting. Remember the first source that I read, that last enigmatic line? It says that this is the day that Solomon's mother made for him his crown on his head. And it says the day of his celebration, the day of the wedding. It says, what is the day of the wedding? That's the day of the giving the Torah. What is the day of celebration? That's the day of the building of the temple. I think that last line in the Mishnah, which is enigmatic, I agree with you, but we already now know what was the day of the giving the Torah. So you'll say, it's Shavuos. No, the day of the giving the Torah is really Yom Kippur. When it says that the two happiest days of the year, Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av, so now it says, and the two happiest days there, the day that Solomon is celebrating, the day of the wedding and the day of the celebration, when is the day of the giving the Torah? That's Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the day of giving the Torah. But what is Tu B'Av? Tu B'Av must be referencing the day of the building of the temple. On Tu B'Av it says that all the women would borrow clothes from one another. So that's also interesting. If the problem of the symbol of Joseph was this coat of many colors, which all the brothers were jealous about, and therefore they rip it off of his back and they pour blood on it and so on. So it's very interesting that on this day, all the women are going to share clothing with one another in an anonymous fashion. Everybody shares with one another.
Plain
white. And that breaks down the divisions within the people. Again, that helps to build it. There's a deeper point that I saw in the Zohar, which I think I'm right. Sometimes you read a passage in the Zohar, you're not always sure what it means. The Zohar says that what kind of clothes would they borrow? It says they would borrow silk, white silk from one another. So what does silk have to do with anything? So I'll tell you. Yeah, you know? It's natural. What else? I'll tell you. What else? Silk is neither wool nor linen. One of the most enigmatic laws in the Torah is the law of shatnez. This law that you're not allowed to mix clothing of wool and linen. The mystics tell us, the Vilna Gaon says it specifically, there's a reference in the Zohar to it as well, that the reason you can't wear wool and linen is because of Cain and Abel. Because one was a farmer, and the other was a shepherd. And therefore, wool and linen represent, respectively, the two different realms, the realm of being a farmer and the realm of being a shepherd. And therefore, the sin of Cain and Abel hating one another, not realizing that each one is unique and each one is special, is what caused this prohibition of mixing the two together, because we have to realize the specialness of things. So therefore, the reference over here, that it's not a wool garment or a linen garment, it doesn't give specialness to one side or the other, but rather is a garment which is made of silk, I think is dealing back with that original source of hatred. This king, Yeravam, he came from the tribe of Joseph. Yeravam did not accept the unity of the Jewish people over Jerusalem, and therefore he built up his own place. The day that this fellow that we were told about says, takes away the guards and says, you want to go to Jerusalem, good, that indicates that he's no longer jealous. Even though the man's still an idolater, but it shows the jealousy is gone, that's already a time for celebration. Because Yeravam put the guards there because of the jealousy. What I think that we can see if we conclude all of these sources together would be the following. The destruction of the temple, we're told, takes place because people hated one another, people didn't tolerate one another in any way that they were supposed to. The core for hatred, we're told, again, in the Jewish world, goes back to the sons of Rachel versus the sons of Leah, Rachel and Leah. In the non-Jewish world, it goes back to Cain and Abel. What we see on this day is a day that people get married, and it's a day when these divisions between the children of Leah and the children of Rachel are broken. That is the key to rebuilding the temple. But one more step. What's the whole thing with marriage? What's the whole reference about marriage? The most basic unity which takes place, which should take place, is the unity of marriage. In order for this to happen, certain things have to be done. For a person really to be able to love somebody else, they need to push their ego aside. They need to get rid of their narcissism. They need to be able to take someone else in their life and to cherish another person, to honor another person. For most people, this is a very important jump. And if a marriage can't work, I'm not going to point fingers and say why. Very often marriages don't work because the person is unable to back down a little bit. They get too much involved in ego. The building of the temple, which will take place because people love one another, will happen when you have a whole community of individuals who are able to elevate themselves, which means that the day of Tu B'Av, which is, we're talking about the day of the potential of the temple to come back, that's why it's a day of marriage. It's the day when unity begins. Most basic unity is this unity of marriage. That's what the Talmud tells us, that when a couple gets together, a couple gets married, it's if you're building one of the destroyed places of Jerusalem. These things are absolutely related. Now, let me just say one thing to end. One of the Hasidic masters, Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin, said the following, that when the Mashiach comes, we all know that the ninth of Av will become a holiday. So you think about it, what kind of holiday? So everyone figures, okay, one day holiday, instead of fasting, we'll celebrate. So he says, no, it'll become a 7-day holiday, just like Passover. First day of the holiday, then there's an intermediate day, what we call Chol HaMoed, and then there's a holiday at the end. Yeah, go ahead, count the 7 days. The first day of the holiday is Tisha B'Av, the last day of the holiday is Tu B'Av, which means the first day of the holiday is the day that Mashiach comes. The last day of the holiday is going to be this time that, on one level, if you look at it, that's what the Midrash is telling us, the day when people will crawl out of the graves. That's the day of resurrection, when people will come back. That's the completion of the Messianic Age. On the other hand, what we're seeing over here is that Tu B'Av, what the Mishnah is telling us, is the day that has the potential of the rebuilding of the temple. So it could be that last week we mourned for the destruction of the temple. 1 week later, ready, seventh day, the seventh day of Mashiach is born, getting ready for the bris. On a deeper level also, you know that the world was created on the 25th day of Tishrei. So we say that 40 days before that, 25th day of Elul, excuse me. So 40 days before that is the time when the idea of creation takes place. That's the 15th day of Av. 15th day of Av is the beginning of some sort of a regeneration. And what we have to do is take this idea of love, not like certain people, as I said in the beginning, the secular idea, it's a holiday of love, it's a Jewish Valentine's Day. That's not what it is. It's a day to break down the ego, it's a day to reach out to other people, and it's a day to try to really heal that which we're mourning for in Tisha B'Av.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.